Welcome back to another Meet Kevin Report. It's July 25th, and today we have a big old flip-flop and capitulation to report on. Boy, that is going to be a juicy one to talk about. We'll go through the actual report of this massive flip-flop and capitulation that happened. But of course, we'll also prep for some of the other madness going on this week. Some things to consider. Domino's, I was exploring yesterday. Domino's, after their earnings beat, is still expecting to raise prices this year after having closed 56 stores in the second quarter and U.S. order counts actually declining in the second quarter, they're still believing they can actually increase prices, looking at 3.9% in Q3 and 2% in Q4 coming. I thought that was fascinating because that made me wonder, I'm 90% sure, but they're not very clear about this when they talk about it. So we're going to pull up the actual earnings call and look at it. But 90% of the time what they're doing is they're referring to this year-over-year comparison. So let's look at the actual earnings call just because I think it's interesting. And let's see if we can get that context. So here it is. I'll begin with updates on our actions to drive long-term profitability. First, prices. During the second quarter, average price increase across our system was 3.9%. We expect average pricing to be similar in the third quarter before moderating in the fourth quarter to approximately 2%. Now, in my opinion, when they say the average price increase was 3.9, they're not coming across saying, hey, look, we're raising prices 3.9% this quarter, gonna do it again next quarter, and again 2% thereafter. Instead, they're telling us much of what we've already recalled, except what we've already recalled is exactly what's kept a lot of people on the sidelines of investing in stocks. A lot of people have heard companies like Pepsi tell you, hey, we raised prices 9% in the first quarter. And so people hear, oh my gosh, you raised prices in the first quarter. This is insane. How could you raise prices 9% in the first quarter of 2023? And then at the same time, people are expecting disinflation. People are going to get screwed. I'm going to stay out of stocks. I'll invest in cash and treasuries. That's the impression people get when they hear these sort of lines. But it's always important to remember how these sort of price comparisons work. Easiest way to do that is visually. So if we look at 2023 versus 2022, it's always worth remembering that most companies took their price increases in Q1 of last year, with some lingering price increases into Q3, more of them really in the first half than the second half, right? That really actually means that if we compare 2023 back to 2022, a 9% price increase taken in Q1 will actually look like an increase in prices in Q2, in Q3, in Q4, in Q1, and then you get roll-off, where if you didn't change prices again, you'd be at zero. That's where you'd eventually get roll-off. Of course, if you increase prices something more gradually and you said, well, you know, we actually increased prices 6%, then 3%, then 1%, then 0, then you're looking at a 6% bump over here. Let's go back a little bit. 0 in price increase over here. Let's draw the price, what the inflation would look like quarter after quarter. In this quarter, it looked like you'd have a 9% bump. Then a 10% bump in pricing if you went for 6 in Q1 22, 3 in Q2, 1 in Q3, 0 in Q4, all of 2022. You'd have this cumulative inflation effect, right? So you'd have 6 in Q1 22, 9 in Q2 22, 10 in Q3 22. Then you'd be flat, but still 10% of an increase. You get to Q1, you're at a 10% increase. Now you're gonna roll the 6 off. Here's how the roll-offs work. Assuming you didn't take any more price increases, you're gonna roll off that 6 that you had in the prior comparison, and now you're actually only going to be 4% higher. Now we're gonna roll off those 3, and then by Q3 2021, you're actually only 1% higher, and then you're flat. So this is kind of how that roll-off looks. And it's unfortunate because for a lot of folks who were reading this sort of headline news on, you know, Bloomberg or whatever, where there was talk about, hey, there's this massive fear that, wait a minute, we're going to end up with all of this this inflation all throughout 2023 because, look, Pepsi just raised prices in Q1, or Domino's raised prices 5% in Q1. No, they didn't. Those were year-over-year comparisons. So if we draw this in for exactly what Domino's is saying here, we're looking at expecting a 3.9 here, 3.9 here, and then we're getting down to 2% by that fourth quarter, right? So you're really getting this more of a corrected view of how we should actually be looking at inflation roll-off when we consider, this is how roll-off is going to function. Unfortunately, and more people realize that in the first quarter, I think they would have invested in stocks more because we would have realized, okay, inflation is gone. Now, that's exactly what we did, at least myself, because, well, in my opinion, it was pretty clear inflation was going away, but not because of lagging data coming to us from Bureau of Labor Statistics or the Census Bureau, but rather my favorite way to look at leading indicators of inflation is actually determining what are companies actually doing. And the best way to see what companies are actually doing is looking at those earnings calls and saying, okay, well, how are they behaving relative to what people expect? And this is really where we saw, in my opinion, a very, very clear shift, where many of the company earnings calls were saying, hey, look, we're not planning on taking any more kind of pricing. We're set. You know, we're just still rolling off some of the pricing we had from last year. And that's really what you're seeing here. Now, Domino's themselves really focused on their delivery partnerships with Uber and maybe even expanding to other companies. I think that was a hint towards DoorDash. To me, what I'm kind of hearing from Domino's is, yeah, we're not really taking pricing anymore. Still lapping last year, trying to figure out how we can deliver more pizzas, but our quantity is going down. And so this is actually a sign that, hey, soon you might have to actually start taking pricing in the opposite direction to get that quantity up. Now, it's not to say that, you know, delivering your Domino's through Uber, DoorDash, or whatever isn't potentially going to increase the optimism that people have for Domino's. But I think that a lot of companies that we're looking at in this macro cycle here are going to be going through this sort of come to Jesus moment where they go, yeah, all of these things that we thought might increase sales, they're not. We're just going to have to reduce pricing, and that'll finally increase sales again. This is a very typical Kathy Woodian argument, by the way, that, hey, you know, if your increases in revenues are primarily driven by these price increases and your volumes are actually declining, then what you have is something unsustainable and something that really sets yourself up for price decreases in the future. Now, keep in mind, all of these earnings calls that I generally go through or fundamental analysis, the vast majority of them we do almost every single day in the course member live stream when the market is open. Hope you can join those. We've got a big coupon expiration coming up tomorrow. Tomorrow evening, would love to have you as part of the lifetime access for those programs on Building Your Wealth. Extremely confident you will love the content in not only the real estate investing course, stocks and psych, or one of the most recent, most popular ones, how to make more money and get SH19 done faster with AI. Get you caught up to speed. A lot of people still today, by the way, wondering, hey, what's a good way to actually catch up with all this AI stuff? Is this just a fad? Are we just going to blow over this? I think you'll find that in the longer term, it's certainly not going to be a fad and you'll want to be a part of it. So get some great foundations via the links down below. Okay, so this gives us a little bit of a look at sort of this I would call it rolling deflation is what we would expect to be coming. And so that'll actually lead us into some of the joy that we're expecting here with the capitulation we have to cover in just a moment. That'll be quite fascinating. But first, I'd like to cover this indicator that some folks are pretty excited about. So let's see here. It's kind of not that surprising of one, but it is a surprising headline. All right. So let's go with that. And then we'll go into actual details of it, since I don't love just looking at headlines. I like getting the actual meat of the matter. All right. Indicator. All right. So let's see what we have here. Hold on one sec. I just want to hear this for a quick moment.
CEO Mike Roman telling CNBC that the company saw strength in the automotive, highway infrastructure, and personal safety divisions, and weakness in electronics, consumer, retail, and China. And you can see that stock right now up by about 2.6%. Then there's General Motors, scoring top and bottom line beats for the second quarter and raising its earnings per share guidance. That stock actually only up by about 2 cents now, so we've seen those early gains for the shares erode. We'll see what happens a little later through the session. General Electric also topping earnings and revenue estimates and raising its annual profit forecast. You can see that stock up by 3.8%, so a big jump. And Dow beating the street's expectations and profit estimates. Take a look at shares of Dow right now, off by about 45 cents. Joe?
Thanks, Beck. The question facing the Fed as it kicks off its latest meeting today, what will central bankers do if inflation remains stubborn, and how will they react?
Yeah, well, we'll circle back to that. All right, so let's take a look at this indicator here. So I thought this was fascinating. All right, here we go. So Bloomberg just ran a piece talking about an indicator with 100% historical accuracy. Now, and this I thought was incredible because it's something that we've been actually using on a regular basis for stocks really since the early 2022 days. We're like, all right, you know, let's try to find bottoms. When we find bottoms, we're going to start putting this indicator up on charts. And that led to quite a lot of good indicators for, okay, where might stocks bottom going throughout 2022. Some signals were a little early, but the fascinating part is the right half of the Fibonacci retracement. This, I thought, is incredible. So Bloomberg went ahead and threw the Fib retracement level over the S&P, and they suggest that historically, the Fib retracement never goes back to a prior low after it passes one of the critical Fib levels after the S&P 500 has a 20% recovery. Now, I thought that was fascinating because we've had three larger 20% recoveries in the dot-com era, only to hit new lower lows. So I'm a little confused by exactly that. So I read the article a little bit more, and what they mentioned is it's not any of the Fib levels. It's actually specifically the 76.4% level, which we just crossed. So in other words, it's not uncommon to have 20% recoveries and then actually fall potentially to even lower levels. But the indicator they're suggesting that's wild is the combination of the Fibonacci and then crossing the 76.4% retracement. That level, they say, has been an indicator, a 100% indicator historically, of not reaching prior low levels. In fact, since 1929, when benchmark equities, I'm reading this off here, suffered a bear market decline of at least 20% or more, of course, the Great Depression, this retracement level proved to be the start of a new uptrend. Okay, let's see. So the index finishing above that level implies a bottom has definitely been set, at least according to historical precedent. The market has never turned around to retest former lows within the following year after the critical retracement level has been reached. They're calling it the 76% line. With that said, the idea that the S&P 500 is within a mere 5% of its record is being met by skepticism, since, of course, we have elevated inflation and otherwise. And of course, we're seeing some market breadth improving, although some people dispute that for earnings breadth. Market breadth is a way of saying that, hey, it's not just a few stocks that are doing well. We're now expanding to many stocks that are doing well, right? Our technical work still points to a mixed picture over the near term, and U.S. markets will continue to base build in the coming months, but this Fibonacci indicator is certainly impressive. And there's an old Wall Street adage, quote, the trend is your friend. Historically, the 76.4% retracement of bear market declines have led to strong forward returns for stocks. On average, the S&P 500 has retained its positive momentum of a gain of 4.4% in the 90 days after the threshold was breached. Okay, now pause for a moment on that. Treasuries are yielding you somewhere around 4 to 5% right now. And of course, I think there are many instances where it's very important to keep your money in treasuries. If you're a company that needs to cash to deploy for capital investments, real estate, feeding losses, whatever it may be. Certainly, you don't want to, tie up your money into long-term treasuries where you might have some potential near-term market risk. The beauty about shorter-term treasury, bills, obviously, is your opportunity to have virtually no market risk, since if you look at like the 3 or 6 month, you virtually have no market risk. But you start investing in these 2 or 10 year treasuries, now you've got some market risk in the event that bond prices fall. And so not always the best to be in treasuries for every scenario, but there are definitely some cases where it makes sense to be in treasuries. The argument here, though, is that if you're in treasuries and you don't necessarily need the cash or you're saving the cash for something, the argument here by Bloomberg is that you're basically about to make your treasury yield in 3 months as opposed to 12 months, right? I mean, think about it. If you were getting, 4.5 to 4.75% on a 2 year, and the S&P on average returns 4.4% in the 90 days after we breach the 76 retracement level, well, there you go. History is on your side of owning stocks. That's pretty remarkable to me. Now, if we look at history a little bit more, you'll find that the S&P 500 was up in 13 out of 16 cases in that 90-day period. So there were 3 cases where it was negative, but the average return in that 90-day period was 4.4%, going all the way back to 1935. And then the index, the S&P 500, continued to advance 180 and 365 days later, climbing at an average of 7% and 13% on average. Okay, so consider this. Level breached, going back to 1935 on a 90, 180, and 365. Okay, they put 5. Usually the banker's calendar is 360 days, but we'll go with 365 since that's what they said. The returns, I'm going to go ahead and put up on screen. I just kind of wrote them out there. 4.4% in the 90 days thereafter, 7% in the 180 days thereafter, 13% on average in the year after. The S&P 500, however, has struggled to maintain momentum after 2 instances, and those are going to be your 1974 and 2009 recessions. Worth noting that in 1974, we were still dealing with rampant inflation expectations that led to the hell of the rest of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, where Paul Volcker came around. And in 2009, we had a pretty severe real estate correction that really punished the American consumer for years thereafter. Your real estate bottom really took 3 to 4 years in many cases to hit. You didn't really get a real estate bottom until 2011 or 12 in many, many cities throughout the country. So there are, it's certainly not a guarantee that you're going to get this beautiful return here on the left, but at least that's the historical average since 1935. And it's actually the Fib retracement's 76% level that's giving us that insight. Now, again, I think it's pretty incredible ordinarily, when we look at the Fib retracement, in fact, let's look at a few other stocks here that we have on the Fib. We have some Fibs up for them. Ordinarily, when we look at the Fib retracement, I'll just go to the QQQ and another index here. Ordinarily, when we look at this, we start getting nervous, when this gets a little overextended, dare I say. We're going to go out on the week on the Fib over here. And look at that. I mean, we are really creating what could be a beautiful and actually very steep Nike swoosh. I certainly expected this recovery to be a lot gradual, which, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining, but I definitely expected this recovery to be more gradual. But my Nike swoosh argument is the thesis that 1 year may be this long in time. I think the Nike swoosh might end up being a 10-year handle over here on the right. So on the left side, that 2022 dip is a beautiful 1 year pain set leading into potentially 10 years of glory. But we are almost at the 100% retracement level on QQQ. Right now in pre-market, the QQQ is sitting at 377. The top in November of 2021 was 404. This is quite remarkable. So it's really something to consider that, hey, you know what? So far, the indicators have been accurate about flagging a bull market here. Who remembers the Chopak indicator that we were looking at back in February and March, reiterating as an indicator that rarely fires, but has been firing a bull market since the beginning of the year. And boy, it's certainly been right. Of course, best way, in my opinion, to continue to look for opportunities is doing great fundamental research. And that's something we do every day in those course member live streams. So if you want to join us in those market live streams, join us every day right before the market opens for the market bell and some fundamental analysis. Use that coupon in the links down below. We've got an expiration coming up tomorrow. Big, most popular bundles, again, Stocks and Psychology of Money, Zero to Millionaire Real Estate Investing. And if somebody's brave enough to go for the triple, they go for the How to Make More Money and Investing in Artificial Intelligence. That was a standalone. This one's doing very, very well as well. So take a peek at that. Okay, good. So that covers this indicator here. Kind of incredible. Let's now jump into, I don't know. Am I ready to do this one yet? I want to cover the big capitulation, flip-flop. But before the big flip-flop, let me see here. Do I have another piece to cover? JPM had a little piece. Actually, the JPM piece wasn't too delicious. So we'll skip the JPM piece. And we'll go to the bear who's flipped. But let's take a brief look at some of the commentary here in the chat. And just see what we have. We also have Martin in Twitter Spaces, whom we suggested would be available to chat the next time we went live. So why don't we give Martin a shot here? So commentary with Spaces. Let's see what Martin has to say. What's up, Martin? What do you got? You got hit that unmute button there. I feel like I'm on Zoom, man. Okay, I'm going to give you a second to get situated here. All right, I'm going to mute that for a moment here. Favorite dinosaur for Max and Jack? That's a good question. I'll have to ask them. Powell, hold my beer. Yeah, tomorrow is J-Pow Day. That's going to be quite remarkable. Quite remarkable. Car for Coin here says the recession is canceled. Yeah. somebody's asking about my thoughts on X. You know, I don't know. I don't think I'm going to be calling Twitter X anytime soon. That's going to take quite a while. All right, Martin, you ready with your mic there? All right, I'm going to give you like 5 seconds to figure it out, and then you can re-request when you're ready. There we go. I just reactivated you. No. Twitter Spaces fails. Yeah, it seems like yours is sort of bugged out there. It says I can add you as a speaker, but then it says you're already listed as a speaker. Yeah, maybe leave and rejoin. We'll try that again. Okay, so let's see what else we have here. The X refresh. I don't know. We'll see. As far as this, quick note on this new streaming schedule. So what I think would be really interesting is trying to break up the news delivery into sort of this this pre-market Meet Kevin report. But then what I'll likely do is do sort of just a throughout the day kind of leave the stream running and kind of be in and out of the stream, mixing in some Bloomberg and CNBC, as I think it'll be a really good opportunity to cover some things more quickly as they occur. So a little bit more quick. But it'll also be a great opportunity to chat some more as well as do some more analysis together. And that'll be actually in a different set. So I might end up just being a floating head in the other set, but that's okay. So anyway, stay tuned for that. All right, Martin, let's give you a try one more time here. And then we're going to get into this big flip-flop. Go ahead, Martin. What do you got? It does not appear to be functioning today. I saw your microphone and then it disappeared.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hi, Kevin. Big fan. I've been watching you since, like, pre-COVID. How's everything?
Great. Thanks, man.
Get over with as soon as possible, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, I see you're very bullish on the market. I was just wondering, in this environment, so I'm based in London, in the UK, and I'm thinking of buying a flat. Obviously, I'd have to get a mortgage with near 6% interest rates. So I was just wondering if it's worth still just plowing money into stocks rather than into a down payment and then sort of betting on housing going up. What do you think?
Yeah. Okay, great question. So in this environment, I'm not betting on a very quick and near massive runaway rally in pricing for real estate, but I actually think it's a fantastic opportunity over the next couple years to get into real estate and look for really good deals, because I'm of this mindset that we're sort of in a pause for real estate, where you've seen pricing that has come down since May of last year and sort of increased since about January. That's at least been the pattern here. I would look at that specifically in your area, but that's been the pattern in most areas that I've analyzed. Some areas are already higher than where they were last year. But let's say we're somewhat on this trajectory. If we started out with this incredible bull run of real estate in 2021, I expect that to be a lot more flat and modest over the next few years. As interest rates come down, we'll probably see more sellers to offset some of the benefits of interest rates coming down. And that dynamic will probably take a few more years to play out, which personally I think is a great opportunity to be patient but active in the market. And so what I mean by that is, hey, be patient, look for a great deal, but be ready to strike. A lot of people take real estate patience for granted, and they just don't get ready to buy real estate. So what they'll do is they'll say, oh, I'll get pre-approved tomorrow. And they basically say that for years, and then they never get pre-approved, and they never get ready to start buying. And then all of a sudden, you're 5 years down, you're like, ah, dang it, I should have bought real estate, you know, 5, 4, 3 years ago, because now all of a sudden prices are jumping again. So from a near-term speculation point of view, I don't think we're like in the greatest rush to go all in on real estate, kind of like what 2021 felt like. I do, though, think that buying real estate is almost always going to be a great opportunity for everyone. I don't obviously know your personal financial situation, but I don't really care so much about near-term interest rates. I'm of the mindset that in the longer term, we're more likely to be facing deflation than we are to be facing inflation. Now, yesterday, myself and the team, we were having a little bit of a discussion about just that, where if we go back to 2010-ish, we'll see inflation was really running at about 1.7%, at least here in the States, between 2010 and 2020, to the point where the Fed was even considering lowering their inflation target from 2% to 1.75%, because they just couldn't get inflation up to 2%. And I actually think that at the same time, since we were rapidly expanding the money supply, it's likely we were actually in a deflationary environment, but the regular money printing that we were doing, that we were conducting, just kept us slightly above deflation at around 1.7%. Point of that is to say that we're likely to resort back to a lot of quantitative easing. QE infinity is, in my opinion, likely to return. And therefore, I think that building out assets, your control of stocks or real estate, really over the next 2-3 years here is very prudent, because in the longer run, I expect as we're back to QE infinity, the highs that we saw in November of 2021 might end up being laughable compared to what actually ends up coming following, hopefully, a productivity, artificial intelligence, and sort of rejiggering economic boom for the global economy going forward. We'll see. We shall see. So thanks for that question, Martin. I think it's a really great question. Following up on that is actually worth noting what China's up to. China, for example, just finally yesterday started talking about some more stimulative measures again. Now, short of providing any kind of high detail of what kind of stimulus we would expect from China, and people are still very skeptical that China is actually going to provide anything, China has once again reiterated that they're interested in supporting the real estate market with easing stimulative measures. Now, there's been sort of this duality going on with China that on one hand, if they just send helicopter money, they might actually lose power compared to the corporations in China, which has maybe put a lid on how much in stimulative efforts they'd like to conduct. But they are big fans of promoting the real estate market, something that has obviously been crushed in part due to reckless policies in China that allowed a substantial over-leverage for developers and the selling of properties well before they're completed, leading to almost a real estate Ponzi scheme, dare I say. But the good news is, in countries like America or the United States, obviously, or England, assuming you're in England, you might not actually have too much fear for real estate in some of the higher quality areas. So I'd say look for those, and I'm pretty optimistic towards real estate. Now, it is worth noting that there are some pretty substantial real estate bears, and I suppose it's also worth looking at some of the bear arguments. So let me pull up a bear argument I was just reading about the other day, and I thought some of it was a little disingenuous, but then again, disingenuous bear arguments have kind of been what we found rapidly throughout 2023 here. So it's actually another one of these Reventure Consulting pieces. And there's talk about this mortgage crisis brewing. And so this headline piece here, which got quite a few likes on Twitter, did very well here. You know, 7,488 likes here is very good. But anyway, this here indicates the debt-to-income ratio for all home buyers. And what you find is that the DTI levels, debt-to-income levels, for new mortgages is sitting at about 40%. Which is actually higher than the 39.1% where we were in the 2006-2007 bubble. Now, in my opinion, some of this is, obviously at first glance, it's concerning. But it's worth noting what this chart is actually showing you. This chart is not showing you the debt-to-income level of all owners of real estate. It's actually showing you the debt-to-income level of new borrowers of real estate. And why is that so important? It's so important because the nominal number of sales that are occurring in real estate right now are actually at substantial lows. Pull those up to show you those. But if you jump on over to the Redfin Data Center, you can see this in detail, and we'll go through that. But think about that for a moment. In 2006, you were actually at the highs of number of properties sold. In fact, we'll see if the St. Louis Fed has one as well. Number of properties sold in the United States. We'll see if we can get a few charts to compare here. But this is important to consider. How many nominal number of homes are actually selling? Why does that matter? It matters because if you have, let's just say, 4 million home sales in a year, selling where individuals have a 40% debt-to-income level, but then you only have 2 million sales in another year where people have a 40% debt-to-income level. Well, then this scenario, while it might actually look similar to 2006, is potentially half as bad as previously because your existing owner stock, your existing debtors, so to speak, is actually substantially lower than what you had then. So St. Louis Fed indicator here, this is their chart, unfortunately, only goes back to July of 2022, which isn't great, but clearly shows you a decline in existing sales here. We'll work on getting a little bit more data on this. But, here we go, homes sold. This should give us, the Redfin Data Center should go back a little bit further, hopefully. No, also only goes back to about 2020. It's unfortunate. I'd like to get a little bit of a larger chart here. But as we can see on the Redfin Data Center as well, we're at a substantially lower level of sales than certainly where we were in 2021 or 2022 by quite a bit. If we compare 2020, what do we have here, 2023 to 2021, you're down more than 40% in sales. Whereas year over year, we're down about 16%. So that's something to keep in mind as well, is that the existing level of owners certainly probably have a substantially lower 30-year fixed rate mortgage where their debt to income is actually way lower than what this chart is revealing. But as usual, a single chart can't tell you so terribly much about what's actually happening in the economy. So I didn't really love this chart. There's some other insights here as well, such as this here, home buyer down payment over the last 25 years And this idea that the number, that the down payment people are placing is declining. This really feeds into people's mostly incorrect notion that the less money you put down, the less capable of a borrower you are. Pause for a moment and think about that. Most people have this impression that, oh, if you don't put 20% down, you're over-leveraging your real estate. But that's not necessarily true, especially if you're able to get yourself a good deal. For example, many of the course members who are in my real estate program on building your wealth, going from zero to millionaire in real estate investing, find great deals, putting 3.5%, or 5% down, to where after they buy the property and they spend maybe, say, $15,000, $20,000 on renovations, it's actually almost as if they've put closer to 20 or sometimes even 30% down because they bought the property below market value. So really, lower down payments, I don't think are necessarily a sign of somebody buying without the ability to qualify. In fact, if anything, and this is something to consider for that first chart as well, the ability to qualify at all today is substantially harder than what it used to be back in 2006 and 7 period. Essentially, anybody was able to get a loan in 2006 and 7. Whereas today, you actually have to prove that you have the ability to repay a loan. That might not sound like a big deal to you, but it's actually a technical phrase in the real estate world that a lender is signing off saying, I believe this consumer has the ability to actually repay this loan. That's because back in 2006, nobody cared if the person defaulted. And you might think that, well, that's wrong. I mean, that could never happen. No, it actually still happens today. Just look at the subprime auto market. So if you consider the subprime auto market, you're finding that the underwriting fees and loan fees that car buyers are paying mean that the lenders still make profit even if 70 plus percent of the car buyers default, because they're taking so many fees up front, and even after they sell the car for its residual value, after some form of liquidation of the asset, you know, repossession liquidation, the lenders still make money. That's predatory lending. These subprime auto loans are not actually signing people up for a loan that the lenders or dealerships actually believe that the customer has an ability to repay for. That's very different from what you have in real estate now. So homebuyer down payments going down over the last 25 years, you know, from an average of say 21% to 18%, frankly matters zero. In fact, there was another person on social media. They made a YouTube video and they're talking about this impending real estate crash. And they did this classic fallacious argumentation where they go, look at this. Bank of America now offering 0% down loans. You know what that means. And then they kind of leave it to the audience to conclude that somebody putting 0% down is actually bad. But that's not actually true, because if somebody has, let's say, a 720 credit score and they're getting a good deal on a property and they're getting a 30-year fixed rate mortgage and they have the ability to repay at that level because maybe they have a higher salary but they have less savings or are choosing to use less of their savings because they can borrow for a 30-year fixed rate term, and maybe they're walking into some kind of race diversity-based credits or subsidies. A lot of these lower down payment programs like the 0% or 1% loans are dedicated to either, you know, Black Americans or Hispanic Americans or, you know, whatever other demographics. Point of that is to say that you can't simply blanket and say, oh, people are putting less down, they must be poor. Highly wrong. In fact, I personally have put down 3% on properties before that ended up becoming investment properties. There are ways you can do that. We talk about a lot on the channel. Just subscribe for more. They're phenomenal deals that you can make fantastic money in. So again, putting down a lower down payment is potentially a strategic way to leverage and not necessarily a sign that somebody is a low quality borrower. This particular individual who continues to look at mortgage defaults versus the unemployment rate is sort of the next chart that they give here. And they make this argument here that while mortgage defaults and a lot of foreclosures are coming, you know, I find it hard to argue that you could say a lot of foreclosures are coming when, frankly, real estate prices have been trending up since January. I don't quite see that. In fact, when I go to a market, now I'm fine. In fact, I was in another foreclosure auction yesterday in Oregon. I walked through this foreclosure auction, and the agent and I were looking at each other. We're like, I realize it's like 0.5% of the market right now are foreclosures, and the leading pipeline of foreclosures is still way below trend of the pre-COVID era. I think a lot of folks forget that. They see sort of this foreclosure moratorium where foreclosures went to zero, and then all of a sudden you're seeing foreclosures return, and they're like, oh my gosh, foreclosures are up 200% from last year. It's like, well, duh, they were nearly zero. You know, so it's just, it's again, disingenuous data. And my goal is always to look at how can we put data and facts together to understand what's really likely to happen. You know, then there's this argument, like it's literally stated here, but for now, mortgage defaults are low because the unemployment rate is low and because people are finding ways to take out other forms of debt like credit cards and personal spending, but that's unlikely to last. You know, I hear that argument all the time. And what you could do is you could look at household debt as a percentage of personal disposable income. That's actually a really important ratio because you're saying how much debt do you have compared to how much money you're bringing in. Just type it in, and household debt service payments as a percentage of disposable personal income, right here, on chart. And I have to, like, my little screen is covering up how low where we are right now is relative to where we've been in history. When we go back to the 80s, people were spending 12% of their disposable income on debt. You go back to 2006, you hit a peak of 13%, actually 2007, 13%. Right now, we're sitting at 9.6%, and it's actually started to inflect down in Q1 of 2023, which means we're actually below trend of the 2013 to 2020 decline in household debt service payments as a percentage of disposable income. So yes, maybe nominally the amount of debt and credit outstanding is increasing, but as a percentage of people's income, it's actually decreasing. So once again, it's very easy to skew people's opinions and impressions of what's actually happening when you're cherry-picking data that looks bearish and then suggesting, oh, well, people are putting less money down. Oh, people have higher debt-to-income levels on new mortgages. Oh, imagine that when rates are 7%. Oh, people are borrowing more. Yeah, but then when you add in the context, you're like, well, less people are borrowing, which means more people are likely fixed. People are actually spending less out of the income they have on debt. And you look at the nonsense of the foreclosure, this foreclosure crisis, where really most of this data is easily put into context. And it's a context that doesn't call for a massive real estate crash. Now, don't get me wrong, did we have our 15% correction up to 20% in some markets? Absolutely. Do I think real estate is off to the races and it's time to, you know, YOLO and over-leverage on real estate? No. I think it's time to be patient and prudent, acquire good deals, ideally in the winter time frame. You know, your sort of October to February time frame is usually a great time to buy good deals because the people who are selling generally need to sell and there's an opportunity to negotiate. You generally tend to see wider gaps in the list to sales price ratio. That's just sort of a fancy real estate agent way of saying stuff sells for less. And really, when we put all the data together, it's like, you know, it's kind of hard to say that there's some sort of massive default wave coming, but it's certainly not going to stop the bearish video making. And again, I get it. Like sometimes people are like, oh, but Kevin, some of your titles are bearish. There's a difference between a title being bearish and the actual context of the video saying, look, here's a bearish title. Here's why people are talking about this bearish information. And then here's how that is either true or not true. And so we can evaluate what's actually going on. So I think what's most important is the context of the story. And sadly these days, a lot of social media is just convinced that there's this massive correction coming. And I think the true evidence of it, and I would be more than happy to say, yeah, there's a big problem coming if I saw some really good evidence of it. The true evidence of it is very, very weak every time we dive into it, which is a perfect way to remind you about what Mike Wilson did. The great flip-flop appears to have occurred. Okay, before we get into that, reminder, check out the programs on Building Your Wealth linked down below. We have a big coupon expiration for all of the various different programs on Building Your Wealth, whether it's the Stocks and Psychology of Money, the Zero to Millionaire Real Estate Investing course, really popular, Do-It-Yourself Property Management or Rental Renovations course. That one's also very popular. That one's actually a collaboration between myself and property managers with a combined 70 years of experience in property management. It's really, really incredible. So some phenomenal insights in all of these various different programs. If you have any questions for bundles, you can email us at staff@meetkevin.com. And we're almost completely booked out with our shadowing experience, which is less expensive for existing course members. If you're an existing course member, make sure to check out the link down below or email us at staff@meetkevin.com if you had some inquiries on that. We've got some pretty exciting things coming up. So keep that in mind. And that does it for the real estate segment. All right, let's go to the next one. All right. Oh, the great flip-flop. All right. Aren't people still sitting on cheap loans? Yes, exactly. That's part of it as well, as you know, you have to think about the lock-in if people still at like 3% or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I put somebody here, Scott here says, I put 3% down and have less than 25% DTI. There you go, congratulations, that's awesome. That's great. Oh, some good commentary here. I didn't see any, I don't think I qualified for ad revenue on Twitter. yeah, it's surprising the amount of revenue on Twitter for a lot of folks has somewhat been misleading to a lot of people. There, here, let me mention that actually. Twitter rev. There were a lot of posts circulating about how much people were being paid for Twitter revenue, but most didn't realize the context of Elon Musk saying that that payout was actually going all the way back to February of 2023, which I hate to say it, but kind of makes that payout look relatively small for a lot of Twitter creators. Again, you know, I'm not trying to bag on Twitter payouts. I think it's fantastic that Twitter is paying out revenue to individuals here. But for example, here's a tweet from Jason from the All In Pod saying, "What the F, Twitter? You're paying me $50,000 a year to tweet." And so he posted that he earned $4,266 from Twitter. And I replied and said, "Here, I'm pretty sure Elon said this is revenue going back to February, so you're being paid less than $10,000 a year to tweet," which it looks like, yeah, look at that. That's funny. After I tweet replied to this, and I'm not saying it was because of me, but after this, they added a community note to this. So I replied to it pretty quickly because I follow Jason here. I think Jason's cool. But actually, well, this doesn't say I follow him. Well, I'm going to make sure I follow them. Now I'm following Twitter, Jason. I thought it was. Anyway, they added a community note. Revenue share is cumulative since February, meaning 4266 is for 5 months. For a year, this adds up to $10,230, not $50,000. That's another useful part of community notes. I actually enjoy that because a lot of people don't see the first reply comment, right? Because if you're scrolling through your feed, you might just see this. And you don't see the first reply comment. So I find that always very interesting. It's one of the downsides, probably, of social media is that the level of context tends to be very superficial. That's a weird word. A geologist taught me one day. anywho, yeah. Okay, good. So let's now jump on over to this flip-flop I keep talking about, but we haven't gotten to. Yet. Oh, yes. This is entertaining. All right. There we go. Okay. Yeah, and again, it's not to say that 10,000 isn't a lot, but there's a lot of work that goes into that. Surficial like superficial. Yeah, I don't know. That's what, let me see. Surficial, well, relating to the Earth's surface. Yeah, she was using it as like also a way of like, I mean, she's a geologist, so it makes sense why she says surficial. But yeah, I guess that'd be similar to superficial, right? Like relative to the edge of something, not going very deep. I thought, I wonder if you could use that outside of geology though. Huh. Anyway, I find that very interesting. Okay, so Morgan Stanley, Mike Wilson, the great flip-flop.
Stand by for the great flip-flop while I take a sip of, from this princess coffee cup.
Thanks, Lauren. Thanks, Jordan. Appreciate that. The Prepper Ninja says, Kevin balances out my perma bear. Well, thanks for that. I'm a big fan of balance. Balance is good. All right. Who's ready? Ugh. I'm ready. Well, folks, it's official. Mike Wilson has flip-flopped. Mike Wilson was heralded as one of the great economists declaring the hell of 2022 and being right time after time and time again in 2022 as stocks just hit new low after new low after new low, finally culminating in a painful end in December of 2022 for many stocks. Yet now, Bloomberg is nearly making fun of Mike Wilson, suggesting that he's hit his mea culpa, the I was wrong apology. And that, folks, is exactly what we need to explore now. Why was Mike Wilson wrong? And what does he now suggest is going to cause the next great headwind for the economy and stocks going forward? Well, of course, deflation. Yes, Mike Wilson is now going from, well, inflation is not the problem, to it's an earnings recession. Oh, wait. Maybe it's not an earnings recession. Maybe it's actually a revenue recession that'll be driven by disinflation, which will be the true headwind. But he does admit in this piece that he was wrong. So let's evaluate what's going on with Mike Wilson. And let's give people credit where credit's due. Everybody can make mistakes. So this is by no means a hit piece on Mike Wilson. It's just to say, I love seeing the bears flip, because now we can finally get all on the same page and we can start looking forward at what potentially is actually a headwind. So, is that disinflation? And where does Mike Wilson say he was wrong? Well, we'll get to that in just a moment. Quick reminder, coupon code expiring tomorrow for the programs on Building Your Wealth. Massive expiration. We're looking at the Stocks and Psych Group, the How to Make More Money and Get SH90 Done Faster, but it's a productivity course, entrepreneur course. You know, if you're an employee, it's great as well. The goal is increasing your income, right? Zero to Millionaire Real Estate, all these phenomenal programs, the shadowing, property management, all of a massive price increase tomorrow after that coupon expires, so stay tuned for that. Linked down below, or email us at staff@meetkevin.com to learn more. So what do we have here? Disinflation is now eating into sales growth, which means investors' focus is likely to shift towards top-line growers rather than just companies exhibiting cost efficiencies. So I wrote next to that, so like actual growth stocks. And the reason I wrote that is because of my personal positioning and where my positioning has gone, since I sold in January of 2022. Again, I, you know, bought back in obviously throughout 2022 in various different buy the dip sessions. But the argument that I made back in 2022 is that eventually what we'll want to look for are companies with true quality growth and potentially even, strong free cash flow, that we would want to stay away from companies with low free cash flow or ultimately a low ability to potentially survive a recession. And some of that is exactly what we end up seeing Mike Wilson talk about in the story. And I think it's interesting because it's a big flip from what we've been used to Mike Wilson saying. Much of what Mike Wilson has been focused on has been this idea of, well, let's get into defensives, let's get into staples. But it's really been the staples that have benefited the most off just that headline revenue growth based off inflation. In fact, if we take a peek over here, It says, what to own in Mike Wilson's piece. As we head into the bulk of earnings season over the coming weeks, we expect performance dispersion to rise. And we recommend investors look for stock ideas with the following attributes. How familiar does this sound? Ask yourself, truly, does this sound familiar to what I said, you know, a year to 7 months ago? High earnings quality, strong free cash flow, and improving earnings revision driven by sales growth. Really interesting, because that's literally what we had talked about positioning, in contrast to this idea that, oh, staples and defensives are where it's at. Which means if you want to counter trade Mike Wilson, maybe is it now time to look for cheap defensives? Anyway, so what do we have here? So this gives us a little bit of a heads up here. He does indicate advertising has been pretty upfront weak in spending, and this is true. We've seen some weakness in advertising. Cyclical housing headwinds are reaching a peak globally. And take a look at this. This is where he indicates this is where he breaks down. Oh, look at this. Jimbo's even talking about it. Look at that. We were wrong. Wilson, higher valuations than expected. Yeah, this is where Mike Wilson breaks down his reasons for why he believes he was wrong. One of the reasons he gives is he argues that the debt ceiling being extended and adding basically $1 trillion to the U.S. debt came as a surprise. I wrote on the left side here, really? Like, it was pretty widely expected that we were going to extend the debt ceiling. We knew it was dramatic, but there was really no moment where people were like, oh yeah, we're really going to default. At least on Wall Street, certainly mainstream America, a lot of people are like, yeah, Donald Trump says default. Get in there and throw the furniture around. Let's go, let's default. Sorry. Then he talks about this idea that, well, you know, be careful because soon 27 million people are going to have to start repaying student loans. But there's actually an asterisk on this. Remember, 27 million people do not have to start repaying their student loans. They just start accruing interest again. They actually don't really have to start making payments again until next year. Just also somewhat remarkable to consider. He also talks about this idea, which we've heard before, about consumers' willingness to borrow on credit cards to basically keep spending money. And this is where, again, I love looking at this chart. Household debt service payments as a percentage of disposable income. Sorry, folks, the trend for the bears is down. You could see the trend line right here on the, there we go. Now you can see the trend line there on the right. The trend is down. We're actually, if anything, bouncing off of the trend line and continuing to trend down. And we're way lower than where we have been on the household debt service payments as a percentage of disposable income. Over here, we've got talk that, well, you know, the Federal Reserve, they injected liquidity through the banking crisis, and that's not fair. You know, they gave us QE. So there's sort of a lot of like lashing at explanations, it feels like, for why basically, you know, Mike was wrong. And it's okay. It's okay. And these are not necessarily completely wrong. I mean, it is true that consumers at some point are going to have to repay their student loan debt. That could affect 5% of revenues at companies as an expectation. But many have believed that markets are already pricing this in. And again, it's going to come a year later than we really expect. This refilling of the Treasury General account and the liquidity issue mentioned over here, that ended up being, of course, a giant nothing burger, which we expected because of the ample buffer in the Federal Reserve's repo facility, which isn't actually mentioned here. There is this talk, though, about liquidity trends not being supportive of equity prices. This is an argument, right? So the yellow line here is the S&P 500. This is roughly the average we're drawing here with the little laser. And then, of course, you've got the blue line here showing liquidity. And you can see this massive gap on the right side where liquidity is actually relatively low relative to how much the stock market has rallied. In my opinion, while this is a red flag, it is possible that liquidity expectations are being priced in up to 18 months to 2 years early, where markets are of the belief that, oh, don't worry, liquidity will come back from the Fed. We'll get there. And I believe that. I actually think we'll get back to quantitative easing, certainly by 2025, 6, and that might be getting pre-priced in. So Mike Wilson does warn that he believes that it's premature to extrapolate the benefits of artificial intelligence across everything for this year, but does agree that AI in the future will be extremely constructive, especially for companies like NVIDIA and Microsoft. Here you could see that the upside move in equity multiples on the back of the themes we've seen has been a lot stronger and lasted a lot longer, been more persistent than they anticipated. That is, we were wrong, he says. This is a pretty powerful piece on Wall Street right now, and I expect to hear a lot of folks talking about it. And it's nice to see the actual piece. Inflation is now falling faster than consensus expectations. I thought this was also quite fascinating, that Mike Wilson is basically talking about, hey, inflation is actually less of a headwind than we thought. If anything, it's falling less than expected. No reanimation of inflation. Though a lot of bears aren't arguing that inflation is really going to take off now. They're arguing that the earnings recession and the cumulative effects of Fed tightening are going to crush us into an earnings recession. That'll lead the Fed to stimulate again, which could lead to inflation again. It's unlikely that we'd see the inflation again that we saw in 2021, but it is possible that the bite of Fed rate hikes hasn't quite fully hit yet. Now, here, Mike Wilson argues that many companies had their sales grow solely because of price. This is something that I've regularly argued, especially when we look at sort of the rollover of inflation dynamics, which, you know, we regularly talk about. The rollover of inflation dynamics leads a lot of these staple companies, whether it's Pepsi or otherwise, to show more gains in revenue growth than they are probably justified to have. Now he indicates that those will be a material headwind if pricing power were to roll over for those companies. Now this is actually what I went on to call faux pricing power. We coined this term somewhere around January, and I said, faux pricing power is when sales are up because everybody's raising pricing. It's during an inflationary time. But in my opinion, true pricing power is increasing sales relative to the competition. In other words, in your class, in whatever area or field that you're in, are you able to maintain margins and increase sales better than your competitors? That is true pricing power, in my opinion. It's relative pricing power compared to those around you. A great example, I think, is, you know, Tesla, of course, is reducing prices, but the entire industry is reducing prices. Which company, however, though, still has the best margins or a better capacity to increase sales than other companies? And quite arguably, that is Tesla. The same could be said about a company like Apple, where Apple might not be increasing pricing on the iPhone, but they're still now expecting more sales than, well, A, ever before, and B, compared to any competitor. Another pricing power stock. Okay, great. So the inflation-driven boom we pointed to at that time is now leveraging in reverse. And this is just a warning again for those staples and defensives, which is the opposite of what Mike has been recommending even up to potentially as recently as last week, where he still reiterated and doubled down on staples and defensives. So something worth keeping in mind on. This is a very big flip-flop. That sort of box of, here are the stocks we recommend. This chart actually is the chart that they've regularly pointed to. They have not. I find it incredible that they've kept it the same. Healthcare, staples, utilities, and still underweight discretionary and cyclicals. Okay, great. Well, let's keep looking at a couple more items here from what Mike Wilson has to say. There are a few more things in here that are quite interesting. So earnings revision breadth has decelerated over the past 2 weeks and is now at negative territory. In other words, expect more potential downward outlooks from companies, pessimistic, forward-looking guidance. I agree, actually, that guidance is going to be a big part of a stock moves over the next few months as we get through not only this earnings season, but expectations for Q4. A lot of fear that Q4 will actually end up being where the yield curve finally bites and drives us into recession. So here's some charts talking about those consensus estimates falling. What do we have here? Consumer finance, net charge-offs are increasing, with the low-end consumer being challenged. Card spending is slowing, but loan growth is still high because consumers are paying less of their loans off. I put a little here because it's, again, when we look at the percentage of disposable income, it's not 100% true. However, it is true that there is a lack of price discovery in commercial real estate because so few were deciding to sell. That's actually one extra piece that I think is so interesting, is so many folks are worried about the impact of potentially a commercial real estate crisis and some kind of collapse in the real estate market because of commercial real estate. But what you're actually finding is because so few commercial real estate owners are selling, it's actually really hard to realize that there's any kind of office or commercial real estate collapse. Why? Well, because nobody's selling or very few are selling. Like you're getting some San Francisco properties trading, very few otherwise because rates are quite high, you know, which obviously doesn't justify buying some of these larger properties at this point, unless you can get a really incredible deal. But sellers are still holding on to not necessarily wanting to give up to their properties in commercial real estate for a great deal. That will change over time, but it's certainly coming a lot slower than expected. And Mike Wilson has a good point here that you could really delay this commercial real estate crisis, which we've already updated many valuations for these commercial properties where the equity is just getting written down, not to the point of actually calling for a debt crisis. We talked about this the other day where basically, you know, if you have a $100 million building and it drops 40% in value and it's leveraged to 60%, well, then the bondholders or the note holders don't lose a dime. It's just the equity investor that loses money. Anyway, so I find that an interesting argument as well, though, from Mike Wilson here that, hey, you know, everything's just going a lot slower than expected and things are just going better than expected. And therefore, Mike Wilson says and admits that he was wrong. So now we have to find a new bear to follow. Of course, we'll still read Mike Wilson's pieces and see if there's any kind of new flip-flop, but I find it very interesting. So that does it for this morning's Meet Kevin Report. I hope to be live a little bit later with more information and coverage. So that is the great Meet Kevin Report brought to you once again today. Sorry for not being here yesterday. Appreciate you. We'll see you in the next one. Jumping over to the course member live stream now. Goodbye.